seconds left in overtime, Johnny Rogers caught a pass in the Toronto Argonauts end zone, giving the Montreal Alouettes a 32-10 lead in their Eastern Conference playoff game. An elated Rogers then threw the ball into the crowd. When the sides then lined up for the conversion attempt, officials discovered that there was no ball to kick. Rogers had discarded the last of six balls allocated for the game, and the contest was then called. No more balls.
What a great moment. You've seen guys. Have you ever seen guys in the pro football do that? You know, in the whole big scene when they get all excited and they throw the ball into the stands? I once saw, though, let me tell you, though, don't laugh. I once saw that actually happen. For those of you who are into pro football or sports at all, I actually saw that happen one time. And I was a kid, and I was out at Soldier's Field with the old man, and he was a fantastic Chicago Bears fan. And the Chicago Bears in those days had a really good football team, which is going to surprise a lot of you. They did. They were called the Monsters of the Midway, right? And they really were. They were monsters. And a fantastic football team. Well, it was a cold, sleety, rainy Sunday afternoon. They played in the afternoon in Soldier's Field. Now, Soldier's Field is on the Chicago lakefront, which is very cold. I mean, oh, fantastic wind blowing in off the lake all the time. And this stadium is a classical stadium. It looks like a great Greek arena. If you've ever seen it on TV, you might see it once in a while when you see the college All-Stars game is always played in Soldier's Field. Well, it's a gigantic arena that seats, something like 100,000. I think 100.5, 105,000 people can get into that fantastic stadium. Yeah, it's a tremendous stadium. And it's U-shaped. It's like a big magnet. One end is closed and the other end sort of opens up. And it's a fantastic crowd there. So we're sitting in the middle of the crowd, way the hell up, about 12,000 miles above the field, looking down into the sleet. And the sleet is coming down and the rain and the snow and the wind is blowing. And these Chicago Bear fans are fanatic. I mean, they're wild. They're yelling and hollering, and the Bears were playing their traditional rivals, Green Bay. Now, this game rivals, it must rival the old games they used to have in New York between the Dodgers and the Giants. I mean, there was no love lost between Green Bay, which is only a few miles north of Chicago, and the Chicago Bears. They really fought it out. And these two teams were at their absolute peak. Green Bay was a great club. And the old man had gotten a seat for himself and for me by fantastic struggling. We're out there sitting there. It was the big event of the year, and the only game that year he was able to get a ticket for and actually see in person. So we're sitting, and it's a terrible seat, I want to tell you. We're up in the U portion. The part that's closed, which is really in an end zone. It's at the end zone. The field runs lengthwise inside of this big U, and we're sitting way at the top of the U part. If you can imagine this thing is U-shaped, we're sitting at the top of the curve of the U. And we were so high, in the stands, that by looking over the back, we could see over the back of the stands, and we were looking down at skyscrapers. I mean, that's how high we were. We could see little tiny dots going down the streets down there below, and they were cars. The wind is blowing, and it's just really, really fantastic. And the old man had won on a punch board. Did you ever win anything on a punch board? Well, the old man only once in his life won something on a punch board. He used to go down to George's bowling alley, and they had a punch board in George's bowling alley. This is where his bowling team bowled every Wednesday night. And he always had this punch board. St. George always says, oh, hey, you guys like a chance on a punch board? And they had this little metal thing. You ever see punch boards? A little metal thing with a little punch on it. And you just take this little, if you've never worked a punch board, you have to have it explained how it works. It's a little board about, Oh, I'd say about a foot square, roughly. And it's all different colors, red, green, yellow. It says, pick the name of your favorite girl on it. And it had all these names, see, like Marie, Dorothy, Myrtle, and little punch holes. And you take this little punch thing and you stick it in. And out comes a little piece of paper on the back, which you pull out, and it's all folded up. And you open it up, and it's got a number on it. Now, some of the numbers were in red, some of them were in green. And after every number, long number, there would be a little diamond or a heart or a spade or a club. So the old man won one historic moment, the only time he ever won anything in his life, at George's punch board. He pushed in the punch, and he got under the name of Dorothy, which incidentally my mother always wondered who the hell he knew was named Dorothy. He never said. he was always betting on things named Dorothy. Like if he went to the racetrack and there was a horse named Dorothy K running, he would bet on that horse. And my mother always would say, who is Dorothy? He said, I don't know. I got a hunch. There must have been some fantastic Dorothy in his life. And he plugged on the thing under Dorothy, and out came this piece of paper. I was with him when this happened. Luckily, I was present at this historic moment, and he unfolds the thing, and there's a long number, like 174960D with a heart after it. And they had a list of winning numbers that George had. Do you remember the list? They had a list of winning numbers, and George is looking down. He's, I'll be damned. You won the binoculars. He almost says, what? He says, yeah, you won the binoculars. Hey, Zeke. Hey, Shepard won the binoculars here. The old man is flipping. And they have to open up the case where they kept all the cigars and all that, where they had the prizes, like the box of candy in the shape of a heart. That was another one of the prizes. Like the stuffed panda that was to be used as a pin cushion. You know, all these great useful prizes. And the old man won the second top prize. Now, the first prize was a radio, which the old man needed, like a third foot on the top of his head. The house was filled with radios. But he won a set of binoculars. Now, they came in this leather case. And from that minute on, they were kept in a special place where the old man kept all his important stuff, like his camera. He kept it. I had another thing that was one of his prize pieces of gear, was a tire gauge. My old man was very proud of his tire gauge. He had a, the kind with a long chromium tube, and it came in a leather case. And and it even had a clip where you could carry it in your pocket like a fountain pen. See, and he used to just walk around testing guys' tires, you know. Oh, yes, I have my tire gauge. Oh, sure, I'll test your tires. He loved this tire gauge. Well, he also loved this set of binoculars, which nobody was allowed to touch. I imagine the retail value of this set of binoculars was probably well over $4. But, they were his, they were his great binoculars. I can tell you one thing. Every time you look through them, your left eye began to hurt because your left eye was in focus and your right eye was out of focus. And then if you adjusted the thing, your right eye would come in focus and your left eye would go out of focus. Now, it didn't matter. So we're sitting way the hell up in Soldier's Field. And it's a fantastic game. And the old man is sitting up there with his binoculars, see? And he's looking down, watching the struggle, the titanic battle between the mighty Packers and the Monarchs, the monsters of the Midway. And they're battling it out. And once in a while, you'd hear great roars coming from the crowd down below us who could see the game. but the fog had settled in. And that was another thing. See, fog would come in from the lakefront. The fog had slowly settled down there, and you could just see these dim figures way down below you running around, scurrying. And you'd hear an occasional roar of the crowd, and you could actually hear the sound of the football pads hitting each other. You'd hear the sound, you'd hear the sound of these great lines crashing into each other, and once in a while you'd hear the sound of a punt, dunk, and the ball would come right out of the fog. You'd see the ball rising out of, you know, it was going above the ceiling, you know, just like a plane breaking through the clouds. The ball would rise out of the fog and then go back into the fog. You never saw the run back. So we're sitting up there, but who, you know, who cares? You're at the game, you know, and these guys are yelling and hollering and drinking and cheering. And somebody had a portable radio next to us, and he's listening to the game, so you could actually hear what's going on down there. And here it is, late in the fourth quarter, the score, Chicago Bears 14, Packers 6, right? At that point, somebody on the Packers kicked the field goal at the other end of the field. Now, they had these, you know, goal posts. The guys kicked these field goals, and then they, pow, you know, they kick them right over there, and the ball goes into the stands. Well, everybody sitting around is... We're, you know, they're all hollering, kick one down here, man, oh, I'd love to get one of the balls. Oh, wow, you know. The whole idea of many fans when they go to any kind of a game is to get a foul ball or to have a ball kicked into the stands. Well, see, we're sitting at the other end. Now, we're down at the other end of the field. Well, at the quarter, they change sides. Now going into the last quarter. So now you got the score, right? 14-9. And it is a titanic battle. And they're going back and forth between the 30-yard lines, these two teams. Guys are throwing passes in the murk, and we'd hear the crowd roar. And you'd hear these hard tackles. It's the Chicago Bears and the Packers. 6 minutes to play. Some guy on the Packers breaks one. Man, he broke one. He's down around the 20-yard line, way at the other end of the field. He broke an off-tackle slant, and he is through the secondary and gone. And the people are going ape. And, of course, the entire stands is divided between two groups of people, the Packer fans and the Bear fans. And there is no love lost. No love. I mean, really. And anyway, this Packer player breaks it. And you know the Packer uniforms. You've seen them. The big yellow helmet, you know. Yeah, and we could see that yellow helmet go through the Bears' helmets. Now, the Bears' helmets are black. You've seen the Bears' helmets, black, with the stripe down, you know, big C. And he breaks through, and he is going down over the 50 yard. He's down to the 45-yard line, down to the 20-yard line. He's down to the 15, down to the 10, down to the 5. He's over for a touchdown. And the crowd roars. At that point, he takes the ball, and he just flings it up into the stands, and it almost got up to where we were. We were in the end zone. He threw the ball up like that, and it just sailed right up into the stands. About 16,000 guys are fighting over it, and they're down below it. And if you've ever seen real pro football fans fighting over a $25 ball, man, it gets violent. Have you ever seen it, Joe? I mean, you could get your head busted. And these guys are wrestling and fighting and yelling, and finally the crowd settles down, and I don't know what the hell happened at that point, because it all settled down, and the football players go back out, they change teams, on comes the kickoff team, and the Chicago Bears are now trailing. One touchdown. Let's see, the score was about 15-14, 16-14, something like that. And with about 5 minutes to go, desperate scene. And the Chicago Bears, by the way, had a very famous field goal kicker. And everyone was hoping for a field goal. See, so the Bears go to line up. They're going to receive, right? They're lined up below us. The Packers are down at the other end, and they're going to kick off. And there's a little conference going on. Everybody upstairs there where we were sitting, everybody thought it was some kind of an offsides or something, you know. When all of a sudden the PA system announces, well, a person who caught the football in the end zone, please return the football. Please return the football. And the crowd booed. That was a great uproar. They booed like hell. Well, I was actually present when they ran out of footballs. Now, that's hard to believe, but on this day, they had no more footballs, and the announcer kept saying, well, the person who caught the football in the northern end zone, please return the ball. We must continue the game. And at that point, boo! Everybody! anybody else, because it is a matter of principle never to return a football that is kicked into the stands. This is a deeply held principle. Do you agree? Well, now, wait a minute. You mean you don't agree? Can you imagine? Why, can you imagine being asked to return a foul ball at Shea Stadium? You can't imagine it? Yes, at Shea you can. That's a cheap outfit. That's true. This is WOR, New York. Please hit the money button, please.
I'm Richard Adler, co-producer, co-composer, lyricist of the new musical production, The Pajama Game, now at the L'Enfantine Theater.
The world's greatest magicians perform at the World Festival of Magic and the Occult, the weirdest show on earth. An unforgettable experience. Bring the whole family. You can hold each other's hand. The World Festival of Magic and the Occult, the weirdest show on earth.
Wednesday, December 12th through Sunday, December 30th at the Felt Forum in Madison Square Garden Center. For ticket information, call 212-564-4400. Tickets also at Ticketron.
Oh, yeah, you know, you can't beat reality, I'll tell you. Oh, no. You know what they did? I mean, of course, I must say, if what you say is true, that the Jet fans are often asked to return footballs. They are not the same breed of cat, then. A Chicago Bear fan would no more think of returning a football than selling his grandmother into slavery. I mean, that is a matter of principle, and of course the fans are on the fan side. Remember this: there's no way you're going to find a fan cheering an official coming over and asking for the football back. No way. So the officials came over and they were talking about it, and they couldn't find the guy that had the ball. Oh, well, no, he was sitting there. Obviously, he had it stuck under his coat or something, but you would never find any fan with fink on him. No way. I mean, he won it in fair combat. If they're going to kick the ball in the stands, they got to take the consequences, right? So they kept announcing, "Would you please return the ball?" And every time they would do it, the boos would get louder. And so the wind is blowing. It's getting colder and colder. They actually took a 15-minute timeout when the officials left the stadium and went to the sporting goods store where they could get some footballs. Or wherever they got them. They were gone 15 minutes, and they brought back a new supply of footballs. And, you know, what a great moment. But I saw a scene one time, you just can't, speaking of people not returning things, I saw at the Struggling Wheel racetrack one time, I saw a wheel come off of a race car, and it bounced twice over the race course, just bounced twice over the road, hopped over the fence, it's rubber, just boom, 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 hopped over the fence, and bounced twice and landed in the stands. Well, the stands were only half empty, they're half filled, and it didn't hurt anybody. The wheel landed in this open place over there, and three guys grabbed it and ran right out with the wheel. They ran like hell with the wheel. Well, we're all basically scavengers at heart, let's face it. I mean, how many times do you walk down a street, and you're walking along, and there's a big pile of garbage overflowing out of the street? Do you ever take a sidelong glance at that stuff to see whether there might be something unbelievably groovy resting in the middle of all that stuff? Of course you don't. Natural. Of course you don't. Everybody here is excluded from all these evil habits. We understand that. Speaking of evil habits, I like to see the reality that's beginning to come into our world. I get a lot of junk mail, and I received a little letter here the other day, big fat one, actually. It says, "Wonderful gift suggestions for the executive or the person, just a walking around individual with an imagination who has everything." And I'd like to show you what the newest development of our time is. Encounter dolls. Well, you've heard of encounter sessions, haven't you, where people sit around and feel each other, right? They used to call them orgies.
But then,
encounter sessions. And you can now buy encounter dolls. And these are wonderful. It says encounter dolls. There's pictures of them. And underneath it, it says people substitutes. Now, if you out there are one of these idealistic, wonderful, romantic people who believe that peace is possible in the world, you know, this is a curse of mankind. He's always felt that if somehow we could get all of the current troubles over, that peace would settle down and everyone would take up finger painting. Guys would join little theater groups. Old ladies would take up writing poetry. There would be universal guitar playing. And peace would settle down. Whatever, you know, peace would be universal, right? Well, I suggest that this new product maybe tells the truth about mankind. It says people substitutes. Lightweight, resilient, or soft foam. You can have your choice. Perfect when a client is working out feelings about someone who is not there. Did you hear what I said? Perfect for a client who is working out feelings about someone who is not there. You can modify them for each client. Plain white surface on resilient foam is easily marked with a water-based felt-tip pen. Names, faces, or anything else can be drawn and then removed with soap and water. Now, what do you do with these encounter people substitutes? Would you get with them a collection of darts that you throw at them? So these are very necessary psychological augmentation devices for today's world. You can even cement or tape on a photo of a place, or you can dress them in children's clothes for added realism. I mean, if you secretly hate your kids, you can get one of these encounter people, dress them in your kids' clothes, draw the kid's face on it, and throw darts at it. Now, you could never get them. I'm sorry, Joe. Let's face it. Many people do hate their kids. Many kids hate their parents. Let's be honest. That's right. They are great targets for the darts which come with these encounter doll people substitutes. Now, you can also get for them, in the name of reality, of course, you can get foam rubber representations of sexual organs which attach to these. Okay? Now, wait a minute, friends. Think seriously about that. Not that it makes any difference. But This, the Japanese of long ago, they're very realistic people, the Japanese. You know, the Japanese have in every workplace, like the Mitsubishi plant, the Panasonic plant, the Hitachi plant, the Toyota plant. The Japanese have a period in every worker's day, like we have a coffee break, they have a hate break. Did you know that, Joe? Well, every plant has a room where when an employee is fed up. Now, you have been fed up many times in your job, right? How many times have you said, I have had it up to here! To hell with this place! And then you sit for a while, and they pour water on your head, and in comes Eddie, and he says, now, come on, calm down. It's Herb's turn next week to get the business. Now, you'll be all right. You say, well, yeah, but for God's sakes, I've been here 107 years. And they put me on the 2 a.m. to the 7 a.m. shift. And not only that. Well, how many times has this happened in life? But the Americans don't take cognizance of the reality of this problem. That most people go around in their lives vaguely mad. Most of the time. Now, would you buy that, Jerry? Not you. No, I don't think you do. I don't think you do, Jerry. You're basically, you would not need this service. But there are some people among us who are the placid ones. And they simply aren't mad most of the time. But most people are mad a good deal of the time. Oh, yeah, I know. Do you know that you can buy now at Abercrombie & Fitch, you can buy teakwood chips for your shoulder. Yes, I mean, these are elegant chips. Oh, you have the plain old, ordinary old-fashioned pine chip on your shoulder? Let me see. Well, you can get some elegant chips now. You can buy teakwood, walnut. Yes, they're expensive, of course, but they're worth it. If a guy knocks your chip off your shoulder and it's a beautiful piece of rubbed ebony, he's knocking an elegant chip off of his shoulder. At that point, almost anything can follow. But nevertheless, yeah, well, you know that on certain work jackets now, you know, suits for wearing to work, there's a little clip that you can put your chip on so that it doesn't fall off when you're drinking your coffee at the coffee break. You know, it has to be knocked off. Nevertheless, the feeling of universal anger is always with us. So the Japanese have taken this into account in their life, in their everyday life. And they have a hate room where the Japanese worker, instead of taking his tea break, he says to Fujiyama or Hosaki, or whoever his foreman is, "Oh, sake, I want to go to the hate room." He goes down to the hate room. And he's got 5 minutes, and he walks in there, and they have these big life-size dolls in there that are made in the shape of the bosses. Actually, they're real representation. Now, you are, I'm not kidding you. They're a representation, though. So here is his boss, Hotsaki. There he stands down there. He's made out of plastic, polyethylene or some kind of a plastic material. And in comes the worker. He walks in, and there's an attendant who's in charge there. He says, "Oh, I cannot stand Hotachi. I'm so mad, Hotaki. He give me nothing but trouble." He says, so. He reaches out there, and he is given a set of cheap dinnerware. Real cheap. And by the way, the union provides all this. He's presented with a set of cheap dinnerware, which he then hurls at the copy of his boss, the representation. And he can say anything he wants. It's a soundproof room. So the boss doesn't hear what he really thinks about him. He can just throw this stuff, you know, little Watanabe is throwing these pieces of plate at his boss, Hotaki. See, he says, "Hotaki, you fink!" Bam! He slams it up. "Hotaki, you bubble!" And he throws another one. See, crash. Well, after 5 minutes of this, he feels good. And he's had his hate period. He's broken all the crockery. And the attendant starts sweeping it up. And he goes back out on the assembly line singing an old Japanese folk song about peace and love. And, now you think I'm making this up. This is the truth. They do. Now, I see that I can see this in many organizations. Now, I think, though, that in the American scheme, it would be not your fellow worker that you would see in the hate room. It would probably be clients. I'll tell you. I have salesmen in television and in radio and in various other fields. After an afternoon with a particularly obtuse, obnoxious client, come back 7 years older, with great bags under his eyes, walk into the office. "Oh, that. Oh, my God, if I have to talk to that idiot. He spent $700 million a year on a station. And that guy has got, he's got a mind like a turtle. He's got the brain of a chipmunk. And if I have to listen to that damn wife of his once more..." Well, now, couldn't it be kind of great if we could have the clients? You could have a statue that looks like J.B. Bullard of, of the beer company, and you could sit there and throw darts and shoot arrows at him. But all of this stuff, the reality of our time. Hate is almost universal. Oh, yes. You particularly find it in the symbolic sense. Sports. Met fans hate Yankee fans in a curious symbolic way. Not actually, but they do. I think this is a great value of sports, is that it kind of gets clears the scene. So if let's say the Green Bay Packers are being ground under heel by the Chicago Bears, the Chicago people feel better. Now, the Green Bay Packer people don't. But then they always figure next year we'll kill them. Like the next war, we're going to get them. You know? So it rarely comes down into the actual playing field. Except occasionally it does. You ever play football, Joe? Real football. Organized. Uh-huh. You, Jerry? You play high school or college ball at all? All right. Have you ever played in a game where hate began to show? Indeed. I don't mean just anger. I mean where it carried over from year to year and began to get pretty damn serious. Well, it got so serious recently, if you follow the history of hate in America, this is a world problem. Don't think it's American. I think the cheapest thing that a writer can do is to pretend that bias and prejudice and so forth, hate and so on, is an American property. No way, friend. If you've ever been to a soccer game, what they call football, in Glasgow when they're playing Edinburgh, good God almighty. I mean, it's not uncommon for 37 spectators to be taken to the hospital with serious injuries just from smacking each other in the mouth. That's the truth. So hate is in the sports sense. But I remember one time a scene where hate began to grow slowly. In fact, it just happened recently out in the Midwest that after a football game that between two traditional rivals, the tension had grown so bad. The feelings were so high that after the game, when the ball players came out of the dressing room, the team bus was sitting out there, and they had police and everything else there to get the ball players out. They were playing away from home, of course. The team that was playing away from home had won the game, which is a terrible thing to do. They had won the game, and so they wound up getting police out there. They had a whole crowd of police. And in spite of the police, the quarterback was shot twice by guys in the crowd. Now, did you hear about that? As a matter of fact, he died. Now, that's a little story that not many people talk about. But, you know, recently in a foreign soccer game, I believe it was in France, it might have been Belgium, one of those countries in mid-Europe, that in the middle of a soccer game, the feelings got so high, the fans began to pour down out of the field, into the end of the field, and were fighting the players from the other team, who were beating their team. And they cleared the stands, and finally, again, they poured down, and on the second time, four of the players were stabbed. One player was shot. They wound up by putting practically the entire stands in jail. I mean, 2,000 people are taken, put in a slam. But this is the way it goes. I saw a guy one time. You talk about curious inverted madness, which comes from satirical things. A lot of it comes from a sense of satire. A lot of pure hate. I was present when one time Santa Claus, sitting in a department store, and this was a friend of mine, was playing Santa Claus. Santa Claus is sitting on his chair there, and all the kids are all lined up, and these kids were coming up and asking him for stuff. You know, yeah, Santa Claus. Did you ever ask Santa Claus for anything ever in your life? Well, now, some kids did and others didn't. This split right down the middle. And, you know, a lot of people tend to think that stuff is all over, that kids don't ask Santa Claus. Well, I was in a department store last Christmas in Philadelphia when the manager of the store, it was Wanamaker, as a matter of fact, the manager of the store took me up there to show me the scene. He says, you know, he says, you can't understand the writing that's often written about things that are happening in America. He says, it must come out of the writer's head. It doesn't come out of reality. He said that there had been a big piece that said that Santa Claus is no longer as popular as Santa Claus was, and large numbers of kids don't believe in this. He says, I don't know where to get that. He says that our Santa Claus here, there are more kids today standing in line at the Santa Claus. And in fact, they had a tremendous labyrinthine setup there. You came through all kinds of labyrinths so that the line wouldn't extend all the way to New Jersey. They had it all set up so that the kids were all standing in great big circles and whirls and all that. He said that the lines are bigger before Santa Claus today than ever in his memory. And he had been a store manager for over 40 years. Now, how do you make of that? And, I mean, he says the Santa Claus is really big today. Well, I had this friend who played a Santa Claus in a department store. You know, when you're first getting started in showbiz, you play a lot of things. And, in fact, you're listening to a guy that played Santa Claus twice himself on television. Yeah, I played Santa Claus, yeah. it was a great scene. There I was. I was a 19-year-old Santa Claus. And, for 3 weeks, one's friend, and you ain't got no tonsils left. And, of course, Santa Claus is always expected to go, ho, ho, ho. He does not come out with a high-pitched giggle. Not if he's... That brings up another thing. You know, all the various minorities now want their own Santa Clauses, which, you know, you can understand. You have black Santa Claus, you have lady Santa Clauses. I mean, why not? So this friend of mine is sitting up on the chair there. So, you know, they had a big Santa Claus throne. And he's sitting up there, and all these kids are lined up before him, thousands of kids. And he was all excited. Of course, it was his first big showbiz break playing Santa Claus. And he's sitting up there, and it was in Chicago. In fact, if you're curious where he was Santa Claus, he was Santa Clausing in a very famous store. Are you aware that there is a distinct social set of differentiations, a social caste system among Santa Clauses? If you're a Santa Claus in a crummy discount shop, you're nowhere near to Santa Claus if you're sitting in Saks Fifth Avenue. I mean, that is... and they get together, you know. You see the Santa Clauses after a hard day being Santa Claus gathering in various, you know, taverns and stuff. And you find that the Santa Claus that's always holding forth, it's like the patriarch Santa Claus, the top Santa Claus, is the one that works in Macy's. That's big time. The Bloomingdale Santa Claus, that's a biggie. Certainly Saks Fifth Avenue. He's an elegant Santa Claus. So Saks Fifth Avenue Santa Claus, of course, has... wears a slightly different... he has a Santa Claus costume designed by Bill Blass. It's a very elegant Santa Claus. And each one has his own little his own little place in the scheme of things. And my friend had started out in... this is the second year of Santa Claus. And he started out in a fairly large department store in Chicago. And the second year, he got a shot at the big time. Marshall Fields. That's the big time in Chicago. Marshall Fields, yes, that's a famous store. And they have very elegant Santa Clauses with just exude dignity and great presence. And so here he was promoted, and of course he was a morning Santa Claus. Now, that's not as important as the afternoon Santa Claus, you know, within the hierarchy, within the actual store. So he's the morning Santa Claus. Now, most of the kids had half-day school and all that, and they'd come in the afternoon. So he's working the morning Santa Claus. And I happened to be present when it actually happened. I sometimes shrug my shoulders when I'm confronted with my fellow man. You know? So, anyway, Scott was sitting up there. His name was Scott, in case you're interested. That was not germane to the situation. He actually was Santa Claus. He played the role and lived it. So he's sitting up on this golden throne they had made for Santa Claus. And all around him were these little mechanical elves. Now, they could have gotten real elves. I would have thought that a store like Marsha Field would come, you know, bring the real thing down. But they had mechanical elves, and all these little elves had hammers, and some of them had saws, and they had sleds they were making in little airplanes. And behind him, you could hear the continual sound of jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. And they just played over and over. They had a tape, see. And he was in a grotto. He was in a grotto made of plastic icicles that hung down. He was supposed to be like in the North Pole, you know. And it was all blue light. He really looked great, but it was high up. It was on a high platform. And thousands of kids would come and see him. And all stand in line to see the Santa Claus. The official Santa Claus, it was known in Chicago, was at Macy's. All the others were called Santa's Helpers in all the other stores. This was the real Santa Claus. In his beautiful costume and a beautiful beard, fantastic false beard. And Scott is sitting up there playing the role to the hilt on this disastrous Saturday morning, 2 days before Christmas. Now, Saturday, is, as you probably know, is a big day, especially if Saturday falls before Christmas. Millions of people were in the store. And there was a tremendous crowd of mothers, all kinds of floor walkers were on duty. The toy department was packed. Jingle Bells was playing out through the whole thing. You could hear the sound of little electric trains. Hey, by the way, I saw a funny sight the other day. Speaking of electric trains, I went in a store, and they had a little wind-up train. It wasn't too little. It was just like an engine, like a diesel engine. It was about 2 feet long, but it was made for running on the rug, not for on tracks. And it was wind-up, and it had a whistle that went oo, oo, oo. Well, somebody had wound up this train and had let it go in the aisle. And it was just going right down the aisle all by itself. And people were walking by it, you know, looking. And this thing would go, ooh, ooh, and just go past us. People, and I heard this little old lady say, oh, for heaven's sakes, what's that? She thought it was some kind of a very large mouse. And the little train went, ooh, ooh, just went right out past. Nobody knew whose it was. It wasn't even in the toy department. It was in the luggage department. But my friend Scott is sitting up there being Santa Claus. It was about 10 o'clock in the morning. Thousands of kids were lined up when one kid came up, sat on his knee, and Scott says the usual, and what would you like for Christmas, little boy? And the kid says, I'd like to shake your hand, Santa. And Santa says, why, of course, little boy. Anybody, any little boy that would like to shake Santa's hand is a friend of old Santa Claus. Ho, ho, ho. And he takes his hand out, and he had this big mitt, you know, he was all made up. The little kid grabs his hand, and Scott went, what the hell is this? And he fell over backwards. The kid had a shocking device in his hand. Have you ever seen those things that give you about a 7,000-volt shock? Santa Claus fell over backward among all the mechanical elves that kept hammering away with their little plastic mechanical hammers. And the crowd is in an uproar. Cop came up. Oh, God. Incidentally, Scott has never been quite the same. When Santa Claus gets a shock from a kid that he's offering to give a gift to, Santa Claus ain't the same after that. Scott later became a left-wing agitator, joined several groups that were involved in bombings of various libraries in Chicago. It's just been a hell of a life. After Santa Claus, what?